couple questions to just get us started. So they're pretty simple. Yeah. Nothing.
I always start with one of my questions. It's simple.
Yeah. This is simple. There's nothing tricky about it. So the first one is, so I'm talking about in school now, in like high school, junior high, grade school, whatever. So my first question is, can creation be taught, creation, the biblical account of creation, can it be taught in school classrooms?
No.
No. So far you're batting 100%. So now the next question I have is, well, not legally, right?
Maybe, but it can be.
It can be, but you'd be risking your job, right?
Right.
Yeah. You're getting to be like Kevin.
That's a shot. It's batting 1,000, by the way, for the record.
Okay. I'm thinking 100%, but yeah. See, I don't do sports. It's pretty obvious.
Because baseball... percentages are to the hunt, you know, like 352.
Oh, okay.
So batting to 1,000.
Okay.
Batting 1,000.
Okay.
That's neither here nor there.
Hmm. Okay.
Since you used the baseball metaphor, I thought.
Yeah, was that? Yeah, I guess it was batting. Yeah, that's baseball, isn't it? Well, it could have been cricket, but yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
No, you're nothing like.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm finding that out. Like, I'm being reminded.
Well, it's like 17 wheeler. I don't want you to let.
Or the, you know, or the like seven bowels of the wrath of God. Yeah, right. Okay, so my next question is, can the Big Bang idea of how the world came to be, can that be taught in the classroom?
I believe so.
Right. So why is there a distinction? Why do people make a distinction? And the people who make that distinction, why would they? What would they give for reasons why one can and the other can't?
One is considered to be a religious or theological view. The other one is considered to be a scientific view.
Okay. And so what's the difference between religion and science in their idea, in their mind?
Religion,
that's a simple question.
Religion is, you know, in most people's mind, religion is something based on a belief system, not necessarily on proven facts or data.
Mm-hmm.
Science is all about, supposed to be all about facts and data.
Okay, great. Yeah, you answered my question just perfectly. Wow. So that's the way it's portrayed. And I think the way you phrase the last answer, you would point out it's not as simple as people think it is. And that's what I want to look at today in more detail.
You've got the rest of us all jumping like jumping pins in our seats.
I don't know. Mary and I are on the same page on this. Like, people start talking about evolution, that's like fighting words. Come here and let me explain this to you.
So if we have time to get through the stuff I have here, hopefully we will. What I'm hoping to show today is that both views, the creation view and the Big Bang view, they both require miracles, and they're just different faith-based worldviews, and that the way that people try to portray one as science and the other as religion is false, completely false, based on just straightforward logic. So I want to start out looking at a couple different things that are kind of interesting. So when people talk about the laws of physics, right, which is what you hear people talk about in school and different things, there's a bunch of different laws, but there's a couple of laws that are considered maybe the most important, and they're called the first law and the second law, right? And the fact that they're called the first and the second, they're almost like when people ask Jesus, you know, what's the most important, right? He's given this biblical answer of what most important laws from God's perspective are. These are the most important laws for physics. So the first one is called the law of conservation of energy, the first law. And that's the law that says that matter and energy can't be created and destroyed. So they can change form. You can change, like in an atomic glass, you take a certain amount of matter and you change it into energy. And in an atomic blast, from a physics point of view, nothing is destroyed. Sounds kind of weird, right? In an atomic blast, nothing is destroyed, because what you're seeing is an exchange from material into energy, right? And so overall, there's never any matter or energy that's created on its own. It's only switching from one form to the other. And so that's the first law, which has never been, there's never been a situation or a perspective where people have seen that not hold. It's a universal law. The second law is a little bit different. It says that the total energy in the universe remains a constant, but the energy available to do work decreases with time. So an example of that would be if you put a pine box derby car, run it down a ramp, and then it's flat at the end. The car, when it gets to the bottom, it's going pretty good speed, and if you have a flat runway there, it doesn't run forever, right? As it's running out that runway, because there's frictional forces there. And so what's happening is that the energy is being converted into heat. The kinetic energy of the car moving along is being converted into heat, and eventually the car will stop. It won't just keep rolling forever. So the second law is behind the idea of there's no perpetual motion machine, you know, like those little balls. If you start those balls going, they'll eventually stop. And the same sort of thing occurs in other ways. We think about the law a little different. We often talk about it as entropy, the tendency toward randomness. The fact that right now this cup of coffee is very mediocre, lukewarm, and by the time of the end of this class, it'll be stone cold. That the heat that's in it is ebbing away and coming to equilibrium with the rest of the surroundings. So there's these two laws, the first and second law, and both of them are considered among the most important physical laws of the universe. And when we talk about physical laws of the universe, what we're saying is that these are concepts that in day-to-day living have never been violated and never seem to be violated by anyone throughout history that's known anything about this. So they're considered to be a description of the factual world as we experience it. So that's kind of something to kind of start us off. So then when we start looking at this idea about how did the universe come to exist, or what is the universe, if you just start at the very first and say, well, what are the two possibilities? The very first two possibilities you come across would be that the universe has always existed. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the universe was created at some point, or came in, I don't want to use the word created, but it came into existence at some point. So it's, you know, either eternal or it's not eternal, right? So when you're talking about how long is it universe existed, you know, you've got those two logical alternatives. It's either always existed or it hasn't always existed, in which case it came into existence, right? And it turns out that either way you go on that, either it's always existed or it came into existed, you can't go either way without breaking one of the two laws. So it's kind of interesting, because the first law says that matter and energy are never created or destroyed. And if that's always held, then the universe couldn't have been created. Because if you create the universe, you're creating matter and energy. In fact, you're creating them out of nothing. And, of course, we have a word for that in Christianity, the Latin term ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, which is what the Bible says happened. So you have a universe that exists forever, it's If the universe existed forever, the first law is not violated. You know, it's just always been there. But the problem, so that's one situation. If you have a universe that's created, then the second law comes into play. And here's the way it works. If you look at the first law, the universe has always existed, say, and matter and energy were never created, and we're okay with that. But then when you start to look at the second law, which says that things dissipate, right? If the universe has always existed, then all the stars should be burnt out by now, because everything, if it always existed, it's eternal and old, and everything should have run down by now because of the second law. So, I mean, it's an interesting. Yeah, I didn't come up with these myself. I was exposed to some of these ideas from a book I was reading recently by an astronomer. Anyway, so you have this situation where if you go with the created universe, then the first law is violated. If you go with an eternal universe, the second law would be violated because it's supposed to have all run down. It hasn't. And it can't have always existed because you have matter and energy were never created. So there's this whole situation where either the first or the second law, you get into trouble with them. So you've got these two laws that exist today that are universal, that are the bedrock of science. And when you start looking at the beginnings of things, you've got a problem where you're going to have to violate one of these laws or the other. It's either always existed and the second law hasn't happened somehow, or the second law was suspended for a long, long time and now it's in operation but it wasn't before, or it was created, in which case matter and energy were created and you're violating the first law, right? So the question you have as a human being then is, if you measure these two laws and you see they always occur, and they've always occurred through the history we know, how do you explain the beginning of the universe, or the origin of the universe, or the universe in general, if it didn't have an origin? How are you supposed to think about it? And of course our answer would be, well, we go looking for revelation from God who explains it. So that's kind of the dilemma. So now let's go to Scripture for a minute. And if anyone has any things they want to jump in and say anything or correct my mistakes, feel free to do that. It is complicated.
If the universe exists, I think about, like, in mathematics, they have a line and array. A line is a line that goes infinitely in one direction, right? And then array has a starting point and then it goes in one direction, right? So the created universe would be like the ray, which has a starting point and goes infinitely in one direction, sort of infinitely, right? But then the thing about the uncreated universe that's just been here forever, because not only does it not do the laws of everything breaking down have to be suspended, they have to be reversed in order for the, because their theory is that the Big Bang happened repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually everything breaks down and is sucked into the tiny ball from whence it came and explodes again and creates a new universe. So not only does the second law have to be suspended, it also has to be reversed in some senses, because you have to create energy for that to happen.
Right. Right.
The whole universe is just an extremely long series of these big bangs.
Like, so an oscillating.
Yeah.
Yeah, an eternal universe that oscillates. So then you do see the second law occurring as it's breaking down each time through a cycle. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it has to come to a place where it explodes again. So you have to coalesce it all again, and that's an uphill energy event, right? So that's great to clarify that.
So I think it's also interesting that either way, just from like a completely blank slate, could almost work if you go outside the universe, right? Like, the universe, based on just the second law of thermodynamics, like if you're breaking that, the universe could exist without that happening if energy is added to it.
Right, from outside.
From outside the universe.
Right.
And similarly, the first law, you know, it could be created from outside the universe. Well, I mean, I guess that's...
Right.
That's just assuming that, you know,
right,
there are different physics outside the universe. But
right.
I think it's interesting that either one kind of points to something outside the universe.
Right, so that,
yeah,
right, so it's making a distinction between creation and creator, exactly, so that all of these things point to something or someone outside the box, which is what we would say, yeah, that's right, that's what the Bible teaches, there is somebody outside the box, who's outside the material reality, both, and his name is God. So in Psalm 19, so Mary, we always call on you to read, right?
Sure.
Can you read the first 8 verses of Psalm 19?
The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. In them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run his course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit to the other end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law is the Lord. The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes.
Thanks. So, when we look at this section that Mary just read, do we see how many kind of topics do we see there? Do we see kind of a disjunction in the middle of what she just read? Do you see that? It's talking about one thing and then it kind of switches to another.
The bridegroom.
What's that now?
Are you talking about the bridegroom?
Well, that's true too. I mean, that, yeah, my question is kind of poorly worded. So.
Otis,
is there a paragraph grape in yours?
Yeah.
Yeah, and where's the paragraph grape?
Break. After 6.
After 6.
7 or 8 or 7.
So why is there a paragraph break there?
The typesetter assumes that God's starting to talk about something slightly different.
Okay. Right. So. So the original Hebrew, there's no break there, right? I mean, there's not even, they're not even verses, right? It's a scroll. And there's certain things that they do to mark the end of a verse in the scroll, but from the perspective of the scroll, it just runs from one to the other. But people who have read this passage over the years, like typesetters, have seen that there's kind of a switch in focus there. And so what's the focus of the first 6 verses versus the next 2 that I had her read? It actually goes longer than 2, but...
The first 6 verses are giving praise to God for the greatness of his works, for the greatness of the works that we've seen in creation. And then the last the last set of verses and on are... praising God for his infinite wisdom and knowledge and understanding and ability to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the verse 7 and 8 is also explaining that these are God's testimony. This is God's law. This verse 1 through 6 is saying, when you look at these things, you should see the law of God and the testimony of God.
Okay. Okay. It's an interesting statement. So it's, in some ways it's too bad we're not reading this in the Hebrew, because I think it helps us. It would help us, although we can see it in the words, the English words too. But how does verse 7 sound if I read it like this? The Torah of the Lord is perfect.
Oh.
converting the soul. Does that change anyone's feeling about what it's focusing on there, the Torah of the Lord?
Then that sounds like it's talking about the word of God.
Exactly. Right. Right. And and so is there a relationship between the Torah of God and speech? Okay, I see people shaking their head affirmatively, right? So speech is made up of words, right? And the law of God is written words, and it's God's speech, written speech. Do you see speech mentioned anywhere else in the passage?
Yeah, verse 3.
Oh, so
that's
awesome.
Verse 2 and 3. Day unto day utters speech. The firmament shows his handiwork. The heavens declare. They're declaring, right? So if you're going to declare something as a human, how do you typically do that? Through your mouth, right? So the heavens are declaring. They're uttering speech. And there's no speech or language where their voice is not heard, right? Verse 3. So you've got the declaration of God coming from the heavens. And when you get down to verse 4, where it talks about the Torah or the law of God, as it's originally given, there are languages where it's not heard. Right? If it's given in Hebrew,
yeah,
and you don't know Hebrew, you're not, right? And so what this psalm is talking about, and that paragraph break is there because it's talking about two different types of revelation that God is giving. The first section is saying, here's revelation that everyone can see. And the way you see it, you have to go away from Seattle because it's always cloudy here, but on the two or three clear nights of the year that we have here, you go outside and you can look up and you won't get rain in your eye. And you can look up and you can see this glory of God because of this. Just seeing the wonder of how many stars there are and how huge the universe appears to be. And there's no speech or language where that is not heard. In fact, there's no time in history where that's not available. And not only that, it's not based on technology. You don't have to have an electron microscope. You don't have to understand DNA. You know, you don't have to know how the atomic particles, what they are or anything like that, right? So this is like what we would call in biblical studies general revelation. It's something that's generally known among anyone who lives, has access to it. And so things in nature would be the general revelation. When you get down to verse 7, where it introduces the Torah or the law of God, or the instruction or the teaching of God, that's what we would call special revelation. In other words, it's something that God gave separate from the general revelation, and it includes information that you cannot get from general revelation. So when we look up at the sky, we see the stars, we see the universe, we see it's huge, but we don't know where did it come from. How did it come to be? But then the special revelation comes along and fills in that kind of information. It fills in information that clarifies things, that some things we can start to see in general revelation, but like, for instance, our fallen nature. Right, if we're sensitive, we can see evidence of our fallen nature, both in ourselves, in others, on the news. And that's general revelation, that something's wrong with man. But what is wrong with man and how did that come to be? You can't answer that without the special revelation that says Genesis 3, you know, Adam and Eve, the whole business where man rebelled against God. So this here is putting forth two types of revelation, and people have come along sometimes and said, well, nature is just the 67th book of the Bible. Yeah, see, now there's a good reaction down there at the end of the table. And that sounds, it's kind of a beguiling idea when you first hear it. Yeah, nature's this, just the other book of the Bible. But the problem that comes into it is that when you have two books and there's places where there's apparent discrepancies, and if they're both from the same author, how do you decide which idea is the correct idea? Right?
Yeah.
You can't unless you put more authority in one source of revelation than the other. And that's what we do as Christians. One time when I was interacting with Chris's dad briefly on email, we were talking about this whole issue of how can Christians believe that the earth isn't really old, right? And ultimately, one of the things I put in there is ultimately it comes down to a matter of authority for Christians who believe that the Bible contains prophecy, which is beyond anything science can do, and believe that it accurately describes the human condition and Jesus and so forth. We look at the Bible as having a higher authority than our own scientific interpretations of the evidence we see. And so what I'm doing there when I'm saying that is I'm saying, I think verse 7 and beyond in this psalm has priority over the first six verses. I'm saying that special revelation is what interprets natural revelation or general revelation. And so the reason we need to know that is that, as I just said, if I put the special revelation aside and I look at the universe and I'm a philosopher and I say, well, look, the universe has either always existed, maybe it's always existed and it's oscillating, or it was created, right? How am I going to answer that? And if I decide that, well, look, one of the first or second law has to be broken in order to come to one direction or another, how do I figure out which of those it is? I can't come to that answer without special revelation. So the special revelation is telling me, here's the general revelation, here's something you see, could be this, could be that. Is it this or is it that? And as a believer, I go to Genesis 1, among other places, and I say, it's that. It's came into existence. So that's one of the differences we're going to see when we look at this issue. Boy, what's the clock doing? It's like really, it's like zipping along. That's one of the things we're going to come to. That's one of the differences in these worldviews, is that we're all looking at the same evidence. Do they like to say we're denying the evidence? We're not denying the evidence. We're looking at the same evidence. But when it comes to interpret it, we're saying, well, we don't just have natural evidence. We have special revelation. We don't just have general revelation. We have special revelation. And we as Christians are elevating the special revelation higher in authority than the general revelation. And therefore, we're going to interpret the general revelation based on the special revelation. And so when we see certain things, we're going to look at explanations that come from the special revelation, whereas the atheist or the secular worldview is disregards the special revelation and says, no, we're going to explain it without appeal to the special revelation whatsoever, because that's religious. Yeah, David?
Well, then, I mean, that's not even exactly... that's not even exactly balanced either, because they're not only are they ignoring the special revelation, they're adding their own interpretation to it. They're not just, because even if you were to look at this without the special revelation, it should still bring you to kind of some idea that there's something else out there, like Chris said, right? There's something that we're not understanding or we can't see, but they completely ignore that idea entirely and go for their own thing that they've created.
Right. So they're ruling out, they're saying you can't go outside the box because there is no, except they do with some of their ideas anyway, multiverses and all this sort of stuff. But they won't go outside the box, and they say that to explain the box, you have to stay entirely within the box. And as soon as you go outside the box, you're violating the rules of the game. And so Christians go outside the box, and therefore they can't play in the sandbox. Right? I mean, they're pushing us out for the reasons that you're pointing out.
I mean, that's illogical, too, because the thing is, if you stay inside the box and you don't allow for any other question that could be outside the box, then you're eliminating a possibility.
Exactly.
A future possibility.
Right. And so it's not really objective science, is it? Because it's a science that says materialism is all that is allowed. But the materialism itself is so goofy because how long have we known about infrared? How many years ago? Not that many. X-ray, right? How about radio waves, right? So if we go back 100 years, those were all ruled out from a materialistic explanation because you can't see them, you can't detect them, it's all science fiction. Now that's part of accepted reality, right? But do you see how, if I'd have gone back and said that all that can be real is what we can detect and measure and have seen, I've just ruled out a part of reality today that's part of that naturalistic bag. Okay, so now I need two volunteers, one to go to Genesis and one to go to John 1. Genesis 1 and John 1. And I'm only going to ask you to read three words.
So has anyone played a board game with a little kid that doesn't know how to read yet and has never learned the rules? And they just kind of move stuff around and say, this is how the game's played. Mm-hmm. And then you say, no, but I've read the instructions. I actually know how the game's played. This is how it was supposed to be. Like, I don't like that. I'm going to do this. That's kind of like the universe. The people without the instructions. They're playing their own board game.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I like that. Yeah.
But when they stay in their own box and they're feeding off each other, if one person's wrong, then the whole thing is complete. But if they don't allow from the outside something new, then when they do it, they stay comfortable. Mm-hmm. Because I feed off the next one and you just keep moving on. But when somebody moves that from outside the box, then it becomes, we have to scrap everything that we just at this point have to go back to square one. They don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right, because they have to accept a source of authority mm-hmm. that's outside.
Well, they talk about being unbiased, but that's the most biased mm-hmm. you can be. I mean, it's just refusing to look at a possibility. It doesn't. You can't rule out the possibility, so you should at least consider it.
Right. Yeah. So who's going to read Genesis 1? Okay, is there someone that John 1 too?
I meant John 1.
Okay, so... David, can you read the first three words, which is actually a single word in the Hebrew?
In the beginning.
Okay.
Oh, no, I said so.
Funny thing how that is. In fact, the book of Genesis, the Hebrew word there is Bereshit, which is actually it's a preposition. The B means in the, and then the other word is beginning. So the Jews... they wouldn't call it Genesis, they would call it Bereshit, in the beginning. And part of the reason, and this is kind of a side deal, but when John writes what he does, part of the intention of John is so that a Jewish reader would see it as another Bereshit. It's another statement of the facts of Genesis. In fact, John 1 predates Genesis 1, if you think about it, because it says in the beginning God created. It doesn't say, well, what about God? And in John 1, mm-hmm. it's actually talking about God himself predating the universe, right? It's assumed in Genesis 1, and in John 1 it's kind of elaborating on that. But in both those books we have in the beginning. So right off the bat, we have our answer to which of the two laws was broken. The law of conservation of energy and matter was broken. There was a beginning, right? There was a beginning. So biblically, we would say, God now in the special revelation, when we look up at the stars, he tells us it hasn't always been that way. When we look at supernovas and the sun and all this stuff, those haven't always existed. they were created. How and from where or whatever, you know, that's still somewhat mysterious, but it looks like out of nothing, right? And we have our answer. Well, it turns out that the secular people also have come to the conclusion, most of them, that it came to be from nothing. Although when you kind of go back to what the nothing is, they're more evasive about it. But because they can't ever really go to nothing, because then they say, well, there was a vacuum in space with a quantum fluctuation. Well, as other people who are more honest in that field have said, well, that's something.
Yeah.
You can't have a vacuum. Even the vacuum is something. We know a vacuum mathematically is not nothing. It's something. So the more honest of them say, well, you're not really, you're still stuck in naturalism, materialism. But that wasn't so much my point, is to say that there's this beginning. And for us, we say that the first law was violated as Christians. Matter and energy were created. And as an atheist, the first law was violated in the Big Bang. The Big Bang violates the first law, right? And in fact, so what is the atheist saying? Well, the atheist is saying an event happened which violated our material experience, violated not just the law of physics, but the all-important first law. And so my question was, well, why should we believe such a preposterous claim? And because the atheist is believing in a miracle, right? So what's a miracle? I mean, if you sit down and ask somebody, what makes something a miracle? What does make something a miracle?
Something that's totally outside the laws of physics that we experience every day.
In a sense,
it's floating.
Yeah. What's that? Access floating. Somebody rising from the dead.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Creation of something from nothing. Right?
Yeah.
It's a miracle. So as Christians, we say, well, we believe in miracle. The creation was a miracle done by a supernatural God who has given us the revelation. The atheist, who, when he's upholding his Big Bang model, also needs a miracle. And that's not the only miracle he needs. But that's one of the miracles he needs. So right off we see, well, there's a little bit of a problem here. You're in the classroom teaching your version that requires a miracle, and you won't let us come in and teach our version because it requires a miracle. That doesn't seem like a fair playing field. And of course, we know it's not a fair playing field, right? So, the first thing we come to when we start looking at what's being taught in the classroom is we come to an understanding that it's not about science versus religion. It's not about objective, measurable facts versus faith in some miraculous. In both roads, you have to have faith in a miracle. And so what we find is the reason that people put it like science versus religion is because they're trying to tilt the rules in a way that gives them the advantage and rules us out and keeps the door shut on our view unfairly. And they're doing that by trying to redefine what the rules are and sweep under the carpet that, you know what, we have miracles too in our system, but we just don't want to call them a miracle. We're going to call them a quantum fluctuation. Sounds better. So, and now here's a picture here. Greg will recognize it because I think he had it a while back. So this is talking about the vastness of space. This photo here is an amazing photo. In fact, I would say, from my way, you know, unless someone had a photo of Jesus on the cross or something, the actual event, I would say this is probably the coolest photo in the world. And this photo is a photo of deep space, and it took 10 years to take this photo by focusing the Hubble telescope at this teeny little fraction of space, and then taking a little, each time they looked at it, they take an exposure. and exposure and exposure, and over 10 years they accumulated 23 days worth of exposure to get the dimness bright enough. And then if you look at this, this is like as far away as man has ever seen in the universe. And if you blow this up, you can see, look at all the little white flecks in there, right? There's actually 5,500 galaxies in this little photo that they've counted. And of course, that's just as far as the dimness can see. There's probably tons more beyond that, right? And so this is like part of what Psalm 19 is talking about. And it brings up again another area where there's some problems. And one of these things is what this helps us see is the scale of the universe. And I ran across an interesting description that helps give us a flavor for how big the universe is, just in our own solar system. And it basically said this was something that this astronomer did when he was teaching in the university. He had his class model the universe to scale, right? And they start out with the solar system. So they start out with the sun that he has a basketball, and that's the sun. So the basketball, you set it down in the room, and that's the sun. And then the Earth is the size of a BB, and it's 100 feet away. And then Jupiter is 1 inch in diameter. It's 500 feet away from the basketball. Neptune, which is the outermost planet, is a half inch in diameter. It's 3,000 feet away from the... Yeah, notice I'm using a basketball, not a football, for the center.
Yeah. So Pluto is Plutoed out, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, he's talking about, yeah, I guess, yeah, it's out. And then he says, if the basketball, the sun, is placed in New York City, the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is in Hawaii, and it's a beach ball in Hawaii. And that's just from our sun to the next nearest sun. So when you start looking at these sort of things, you're talking about just this huge, huge distance. And it turns out that that is a problem. It's a problem for us in Genesis, and it's a problem for the Big Bang guys too. But the Big Bang guys, it's not often seen as in the same sense. So what I'm talking about is this idea of, well, how long does it take starlight to come from these dimmest things in here, right? Like that one right there, which is made up of all kinds of dim things. Right? You can see it's a big thing. So, how long does it take for that stuff to come?
You'd be actually watching the creation.
Well, that's the idea. That's what they're saying. They're saying, well, what we're seeing here, these have to be all the younger ones. In fact, I haven't even talked about it because I'm running out of time. But in this thing here, part of the idea, if you look at the explanation, they're going to tell you that those are all young galaxies, because according to their view, they have to be, right? Because that they're looking back into the very beginning of the universe. But Greg and I would say, well, that's pretty dense. That's pretty dense picture for the very. How did I get that better?
Yeah.
How come it's not a whole lot more sparse? And how come when we go like that, it looks like it. There's still tons more back there.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it should be thinning out. But anyway, that's a whole different issue. but part of the thing here is that, so we know when we drive a car, we're going to go 50 miles in the car today, and we're driving 50 miles an hour. How long is it going to take us to get there?
An hour.
So we're using an equation, right? And we're using, we don't think of it this way, we're using Newtonian physics, right? Isaac Newton, right? The guy with the fig or apple or whatever it was, right?
Isaac Newton.
And so we're using time as distance divided by speed. That's how we figure out how long it's going to get. We don't think about it that way. We just do it. And so, but the problem is there's this light travel time issue, right? Like, if God created in 6 days, right? And this is a whole other thing I don't want to get really sucked into, but so we have a challenge as Christians, because we look at these distance stars supposed to be so many light years away, millions of light years away, and there's a light here coming from there, and if it traveled from there at the current speed of light, and then how it took that many billions of years, right? So the universe must be 15 billion years old or whatever. That's part of the argument, right? And so we go to our special revelation and we say, well, that's not what the special revelation says. Okay, and so now we've got an argument, an apparent argument. And what did I say earlier about where do we go for the authority when there's an apparent discrepancy? There's a discrepancy not in the world and God's word. There's a discrepancy in our attempt to understand the world, our explanations of the world, what we think the world is saying when we look there versus what God's special revelation says. And so at this church, we always raise our hand and say, well, we're sticking with the scripture, what it clearly is teaching, although there's a challenge now. How do we put these together? And there are ideas about how to do that. But I'm just mainly pointing out now in the Christian worldview, there's a challenge there. There's a Bible difficulty, a natural revelation difficulty, a general revelation difficulty.
Which is
how long does it take the starlight to get here versus the world only being 6,000 years old, roughly? If there's only been 6,000 years, how come we can see light from...
He's saying that if the world is only 6,000 years old, we wouldn't be able to see a lot of this. Because the light doesn't travel fast enough for us to reach our eyes.
Yet.
Yeah.
Right.
Elijah will explain it to you.
Okay.
So...
She has to all the time.
So
theoretically, you don't even know if that star exists yet.
Yeah.
Because it could have something happened to it, and that light just getting here. It could have been...
Yeah, that's a very complicated area, and I'm hoping to skirt it. Okay. That's something we could talk about another time. But my main point is to say we have this challenge, this difficulty. And if we're honest, we raise our hand and say, yeah, that's hard to understand. How do we put that together? Okay. And so now what I want to talk about though is, I got to go to a different picture now. Okay, there's a different picture. Have you seen that picture before?
No.
Yeah, somebody has. Yeah, a couple of you. So, those of you who have seen the picture, what is this a picture of? I mean, roughly.
I don't know. I've
just
seen the picture.
It's similar to the last one, but it's...
Okay, so this is what... This is what's called the cosmic microwave background.
Right.
Okay, and so it's a map of the energy they measure by looking in every direction from the Earth out into space and factoring out the near scale stuff and looking at the empty spots basically to try and see what kind of microwave. Now think about this too, that a few years ago, they couldn't have done this if they were materialistic naturalists, because there's no microwaves yet. They couldn't even detect them, right? So now anyway, they can detect microwaves. They look out there and they find out that, and the reason this looks like kind of like an old time map a little bit, the shape of it, is because it's an unrolled sphere. So if you take, what do you do with a map? The Earth's round, you got to unroll it. And there's various projections, Mercator's projections, whatever, where you flatten out the Earth, and so this, flatten out. You project the Earth into a different. you use a different projection. So if you were to roll this up, kind of, if you imagine curving that around and putting it together, you end up with a sphere.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what it is. It's a sphere then rolled out flat, and. What this shows, there's some variations. These colors are various measurements of energy. And the fact that the colors are almost all very close is basically, even though it looks different to us, they're basically saying within just minute amounts of temperature, it's all the same temperature. So they're looking out in space and they're saying all of space out there behind where there's nothing, as far as we can tell, is all at the same temperature within this minute accuracy. And so how did that come to be? Well, in the big bang, model, the inference is that all these distant regions of the universe were at one time together. Because you can't get two areas to be exactly the same temperature unless they are connected in some way where the one that's slightly higher will ooze out to the one that's slightly lower and they'll reach an equilibrium. But the basic idea is that information or energy has to flow between the two areas in order. This is the naturalistic explanation. Obviously, with God, God could do any of this. But in the naturalistic explanation, if I've got a cup of cold milk and a hot coffee, and I'll put them next to each other, after a while, the milk will come up a little bit and the coffee will go down a little bit, and they'll be at the same temperature. And the reason they're so precisely at the same temperature is that they're in the same environment together. And so to see something that's way, 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 way over there that's at a certain temperature and something that's super far over there and another, and they're both really close to the same temperature, how did they know what temperature to be at that's the same? And the answer for the Big Bang is that they were together at some point, right? And so now we go to the next picture, which... So this is a... Have you ever seen this kind of cornucopia picture? Yeah. This is the history of the universe, by the way. In a nice picture. It's the timeline of the Big Bang.
And,
yeah. So here's the quantum fluctuation that they would posit. We don't have a quantum fluctuation in our model, but that's their quantum fluctuation. And notice this next word here, it's called inflation.
Yeah.
Inflation. Well, what happens during inflation? Well, it turns out that if you look at the age of the universe according to the secular model, and you look at how far away these regions are that are the same temperature, there's still not enough time at the speed of light for them to have once time been together. So far apart at the speed of light, it's still there's still not enough time.
Well, and similarly, you can go the other direction from our problem, where why can't you see the end of the universe? If it was traveling at the speed of light,
right,
you wouldn't be able to see the end of the universe because light from the end of the universe would be reaching us.
So. Right. So he's talking about this thing called the event horizon, which is basically saying if nothing travels faster than the speed of light, there's always somewhere that's too far away from an event that just happened or given a certain amount of time, it takes a while for that light or information, not just light, but any information, including temperature or energy, to travel out at the speed of light. So something like, let's say you were way outside somewhere in space somehow and there's an event that occurs, you're not going to see it for so many, many, many years till the light gets there, and that's the event horizon. So inside that horizon or that expanding area, the information from the event is known. Outside of it, you're in the dark, right? And so in this picture here, this expanding cone is expanding at the speed of light in this section here, but here it looks like it expanded a lot faster. So here is a place where, and notice at the base here, they've got this cosmic background photo rotated and inserted in there. You can kind of see it right in there. Okay. So at that point, this stuff is going out way, way, way faster than the speed of light. So has anyone ever seen anything move faster than the speed of light? According to Einstein, can anything ever move faster than the speed of light? No. What would we call that in Christian terms? A miracle. Okay, so there's a second miracle in the Big Bang. Right? Right? So you mean you're teaching miracles in the classroom? Yeah. They're teaching miracles in the classroom. We've run on two so far. Pretty big ones, right? So there's this whole problem. The Big Bang has a light travel problem. gosh, Christians have a light travel problem. Gosh, not only do we both have miracles, but we have a similar and related kind of problem. Ours is, how did that starlight get here by conventional time, right? And theirs is, how did the temperature get equalized out in the amount of time? Somehow something traveled, either time was different or speed was different, something was different. The regular equation that were, you know, the regular equations didn't hold for that to occur. And if they didn't hold, they're a violation of everything we know and experience. That is called a miracle. Okay, so now let's go to our, oh gosh, this is crazy. Okay, so it's a time thing. That's horrible. Okay, so I'll try to briefly just touch on two things, and we're kind of out of time. So the third thing, and this one is interesting too. Come on. So another aspect of the Big Bang is this. This is a chart of what's called dark energy or dark matter. And so the Big Bang also requires that a large amount of the universe, in fact, 95% of the universe, is made up of stuff we can't detect. Right? So dark energy and dark matter, the reason they're called dark, because as far as we know, they don't exist. They're predicted to exist because of beliefs associated with the Big Bang, but nobody's found them. And they've put a lot of effort, and a lot of the big collision stuff that's being done in these tunnels in Europe and all this kind of stuff is to find evidence of dark matter, dark energy. And the reason this stuff's hard to detect is, you've heard of neutrinos, right, things like that. Certain, if it's dark and you can't detect it, it's because it doesn't interact with other matter in the universe. It's a different kind of matter, dark matter. So you can't detect it with magnetism. It doesn't respond to certain aspects of gravity, you know. So there's a lot of aspects to it. But the point is, they are saying that 95% of what's out there, you can't see. But it's out there. Take our word for it. It's out there.
So they're basically making it up because otherwise the Big Bang couldn't be.
Well, yeah. And
have it.
They have to have it. For the Big Bang and certain, they're also, it has to do with how they're interpreting certain measurements they make about how galaxies spin and things like that. But since I'm running out of time, let me just read this. This is, here's a couple quotes from people who are knowledgeable in that field that are not creationists. Although dark matter has not been directly observed, its existence and properties are inferred from its gravitational effects, such as the motions of normal matter, gravitational lensing, its influence on the universe's large-scale structure, on the formation of galaxies, and its effects on the cosmic microwave background. A lot of these are kind of inferred. According to consensus among cosmologists, this is secular ones, dark matter is composed primarily of a not yet characterized type of subatomic particle. The search for this particle by a variety of means is one of the major efforts in particle physics. And it says here that in philosophy of science, dark matter is an example of an auxiliary hypothesis, an ad hoc postulate that is added to a theory in response to observations thought to falsify it. It has been argued that the dark matter hypothesis is a convention, what they call a conventionalis hypothesis, that is, a hypothesis that adds no empirical content and hence is unfalsifiable in the sense defined by the philosopher of science, Karl Popper. They're saying that, just what Mary said, is that it's a postulated thing they have to have for their other theories to work, but it's never been observed and it's questionable whether it could be falsifiable, because if it's truly dark, if dark's truly dark, you'll never detect it, right? And then here's another one. the lack of a definite detection of dark matter particles in both underground experiments and at the Large Hadron Collider, as a particle smasher, has had a palpable effect on the community of scientists that study particulate dark matter. Even though a discovery could very plausibly be right around the corner, there's a widespread view that many of the most theoretically attractive candidates for dark matter should have been detected by now. In the absence of such a discovery, the field has begun to redirect efforts toward new and sometimes very different ideas. Notice they're going to maybe move away from dark matter. Although this state of affairs can certainly be frustrating at times, it's also the positive effect of ushering in an explosion in dark matter model building. In other words, we can't find it, so we better figure out.
Let's build more.
Right. So it's required for the Big Bang. It's never been observed. There's no evidence. It's special pleading. That's what we would call secular blind faith.
Yeah.
You see how similar?
Yeah.
So the last thing I'll just mention, I won't read here, but the other miracle, so there's that aspect too, which is they're believing in something that there's no evidence for. That's objective science, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then the last thing, of course, we haven't had a chance to look at, but life from non-life. Mm. That's the other miracle that they're teaching in the classroom, that life evolved from non-life, and I have a bunch of quotes and stuff about that too, but so we've talked about basically four miracles that the Big Bang and the non-theistic idea of how we came to be require. That all, there are things that have never been observed, can't be proven, and are assumed by the secular view that's allowed to be taught in the classrooms. And our view, which has miracles too, based on special revelation from God, can't be on the playing field. Because ours is religious, and theirs is just based on the facts of science. You see the ridiculousness there, the false. And so what that should do, if you're not a Christian, everyone here is Christian, but if you're not a Christian, what that should make you wonder is, why is that? Why is it biased that one way? Why is it biased in a way where the theistic view is pushed off the playing field and has pretty much the same characteristics as the secular view? And the answer is, of course, that it's not a neutral, the world is not neutral. And that the biblical view of man rejecting and moving from God is what's really at work below it all.